This chapter of Exodus, chapter 12, is almost a book unto itself. Here, the festival or the ordinance of Passover, Pesach, is established. In fact, another God-ordained feast, the festival of unleavened bread, matzah, is also laid out. Now, the important details and timing and who may participate and who may not are all described. These details are rich, they're full of spiritual meaning, and we will discuss them. Now, this chapter also includes the carrying out of God's decree that he shall kill by his own hand all the firstborn of Egypt, that's people and livestock. It ends with the people of Israel packing up and quickly leaving Egypt, once again giving us some important information about who went, how many, where they went. Now, just for the sake of organizing our thoughts to take on the important facts and meaning contained in this 12th chapter of Exodus, it helps if we can see it arranged in five parts. Verses 1 through 14 are God directing Moses on the details of establishing the first Passover. Verses 15 through 20 look to the future, as these details are meant for future Passover celebrations. Verses 21 through 27 have Moses communicating to the people, actually the elders of Israel, all that God has instructed him. Verse 28 records the people of Israel being obedient to Moses and to God. And verse 29, to the end of the chapter, describes the horror of that dreadful night. The thousands upon thousands of Egyptian firstborns, human and animal, were killed by Jehovah for the sake of Israel. And then goes on to describe the first stages of the Hebrews' exodus from captivity in Egypt. So, let's begin. Open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 12. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's on page 71. Exodus chapter 12. We'll read the whole chapter. Adonai spoke to Moshe and Aharon in the land of Egypt, and he said, "You are to begin your calendar with this month. It will be the first month of the year for you. Speak to all the assembly of Israel and say, on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb or kid for his family, one per household, except that if the household is too small for a whole lamb or kid, then he and his next door neighbor should share one, dividing it in proportion to the number of people eating it. Your animal must be without defect, a male in its first year, and you may choose it from either the sheep or the goats. You are to keep it until the 14th day of the month, and then the entire assembly of the community of Israel will slaughter it at dusk. They are to take some of the blood and smear it on the two sides and top of the door frame at the entrance of the house in which they eat it. That night they are to eat the meat, roasted in the fire. They are to eat it with matzah and maror. Don't eat it raw or boiled, but roasted in the fire with its head, the lower parts of its legs, and its inner organs. Let nothing of it remain until morning. If any of it does remain, burn it up completely. Here's how you are to eat it: with your belt fastened, your shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you are to eat it hurriedly. It is Adonai's Pesach, Passover. For that night, I will pass through the land of Egypt and kill all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both men and animals, and I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt. I am Adonai. The blood will serve you as a sign marking the houses where you are. When I see the blood, I will pass over. And when I strike the land of Egypt, the death blow will not strike you. There will be a day for you to remember and to celebrate as a festival for Adonai. From generation to generation, you are to celebrate it by perpetual regulation. For 7 days, you are to eat matzah. On the first day, remove the leaven from your house. For whoever eats hametz, that's leavening, from the first to the seventh day is to be cut off from Israel. On the first and seventh days, you are to have an assembly set aside for God. On these days, no work is to be done except what each must do to prepare his food. You may do only that. You are to observe the festival of Matzah, for on this very day I brought your divisions out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you are to observe this day from generation to generation by perpetual regulation. From the evening of the 14th day of the first month until the evening of the 21st day, you are to eat matzah. And during those 7 days, no leaven is to be found in your houses. Whoever eats food with chametz is to be cut off from the community of Israel. It doesn't matter whether he's a foreigner or a citizen of the land. Eat nothing with leavening in it. Wherever you live, eat matzah. And then Moses called for all the leaders of Israel and said, select and take lambs for your families. Slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop leaves, dip it in the blood which is in the basin and smear it on the two sides and top of the door frame. Then none of you is to go out the door of his house until morning. For Adonai will pass through to kill the Egyptians. But when he sees the blood on the top of the two sides, Adonai will pass over the door and will not allow the slaughterer to enter your houses and kill you. You are to observe this as a law, you and your descendants forever. When you come to the land which Adonai will give you, as is promised, you are to observe the ceremony. When your children ask you, what do you mean by this ceremony? Say, it is the sacrifice of Adonai's Passover. Because Adonai passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he killed the Egyptians, but he spared our houses. The people of Israel bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the people of Israel went and did as Adonai had ordered Moses and Aaron. This is what they did. At midnight, Adonai killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the prisoner in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. Pharaoh got up in the night. He, all his servants, all the Egyptians, and there was a horrendous wailing in Egypt, for there wasn't a single house without someone dead in it. He summoned Moses and Aaron by night, and he said, up, leave my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go and serve Adonai as you said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you said, and get out of here. Oh, but bless me too. The Egyptians pressed to send the people out of the land quickly because they said, otherwise we'll all be dead. The people took their dough before it had become leavened. They wrapped their kneading bowls in their clothes on their shoulders. The people of Israel had done what Moses had said. They had asked the Egyptians to give them silver and gold, jewelry and clothing. And Adonai had made the Egyptians so favorably disposed towards the people that they had let them have whatever they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. The people of Israel traveled from Ramesses to Sukkot, some 600,000 men on foot, not counting children. A mixed crowd also went up with them, as well as livestock in large numbers, both flocks and herds. They baked matzah loaves from the dough they had brought out of Egypt, since it was unleavened, because they had been driven out of Egypt without time to prepare supplies for themselves. The time the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of the 430 years, to the day, all the divisions of Adonai left the land of Egypt. This was a night when Adonai kept vigil to bring them out of the land of Egypt, and this same night continues to be a night when Adonai keeps vigil for all the people of Israel throughout all their generations. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, this is the regulation for the Pesach lamb. No foreigner is to eat it. But if anyone has a slave he bought for money, when you've circumcised him, he may eat it. Neither a traveler nor a hired servant may eat it. It is to be eaten in one house. You are not to take any of the meat outside the house. You are not to break any of its bones. The whole community of Israel is to keep it. If a foreigner staying with you wants to observe Adonai's Passover, then his males must be circumcised. Then he may take part and observe it. He will be like a citizen of the land, but no uncircumcised person is to eat it. The same teaching is to apply equally to the citizen and to the foreigner living among you. All the people of Israel did just as Adonai had ordered Moshe and Aharon. On that very day, Adonai brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their divisions. Verse 1 leaves us no doubt where and when this feast of Pesach, Passover, began. But verse 2 causes us some confusion if we're not careful, because it seems that God is establishing the Jewish calendar year. Now, those of you who know a little bit about the Jewish calendar and the seven yearly feasts, know that Passover is a springtime festival. Passover occurs in the Jewish month of Aviv, which is what it was first called, now it's called Nisan. The names of the 12 months of the year were originally Hebrew, but during their exile to Babylon, some 800 years after the Exodus, the Jews changed the names of the month from Hebrew to the Babylonian names. Some sects of Judaism have stubbornly clung to the more ancient Hebrew names for each month, although most accept the more common Babylonian names. However, the Hebrew versus the Babylonian isn't the point of the confusion that I'm concerned with. Clearly, God tells Israel in verse 2 that this Passover month, Nisan, is, or Aviv, is to be the first month of the year. First month of the year. So, one would think that the first day of the first month of the year would be what?
New Year's Day.
In other words, just as we follow the Julian calendar today, where January is the first month of the year, so on the 1st of January, we celebrate New Year's Day. The new year begins. However, Rosh Hashanah, which is the name for the Jewish New Year, literally means head of the year. But it does not occur on the first day of Nisan. The first month of the Jewish calendar year is not Nisan. In fact, Rosh Hashanah doesn't even occur, head of the year, Jewish New Year, until the fall season, several months after Passover in the month of Tishri. What gives? The Jews actually have several kinds of New Year's. Okay? Just as we have a cycle that begins with January 1st and ends on December 31st for marking a calendar year, if you own a business, you have also what's called a fiscal year. And a fiscal year can start in any month you choose. A fiscal year has primarily to do with taxation and accounting. If you go to school, I'm looking at some kids here, better. You know that the school year will vary from institution to institution. It's somewhat arbitrary. Sometimes it changes year to year. It's not connected to a business fiscal year or the 12-month calendar year. If you're a farmer, your year is based more on the cycles of agriculture. And since all the Hebrew festivals are based around agriculture in one way or another, they are not necessarily in tune with the calendar year, but rather it's more about the cycle of seasons. And there are even more kinds of yearly calendar measurements that I could use as examples. So according to the Jewish calendar, Nisan, as described here in verse 2, is considered the month for counting the years of reigns of kings and queens. It's also the first month of the Jewish religious calendar year. The Jewish month of Elul, which is approximately our August, begins the yearly tithing cycle when it comes to tithing animals. The month of Shevat, about February, begins the yearly cycle for determining which fruits of the tree harvest can be eaten, which have to be tithed. The first day of Tishri, which is also called Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is used to determine when the number of the year changes. That is, when on 12:01 a.m. on the first day of January, we will go from 2016 to 2017, then the next year from 2017 to 2018, and so on. Every 12 months, on the first day of the new year, the number of the year increases by one. Well, that's easy enough, but the Jews have a specific month that they change the calendar years, and it's not Nisan. Rather, it is somewhat mid-calendar year that the Jews advance the year by one. It's also the month that they add days or weeks even to their calendars from time to time, because they use a lunar calendar as their basis. So adjustments have to be made every few years to keep the calendars accurate and in line with the solar calendar. Not isn't that easy?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's not important that you remember all this in detail. But it is important to understand that the biblical calendar is nothing like our current nice, neat, solar-based 365 and a quarter day calendar. So when we come to the establishment of festival days in the Bible, or the dates of specific events, or when it talks about how long a certain king reigned, you have to think in terms of the Jewish calendar system with all of its variations, not our modern calendar system. What we know is that the first Passover, marking the night before the Jews left Egypt, was in the spring, so what we think is March, April time frame. And in verse 3, based on the Jewish lunar calendar, God instructs Israel that on the 10th day of that month of Nisan, 4 days before Passover, they're to select, not kill, just select the lamb that's to be used as their Passover sacrifice. And before we go any further, let me dispel some myths about this lamb. First of all, this is a male lamb. It specifically calls that out. Second, it has to be a yearling. In other words, around a year old. So we're not talking about some cute, fuzzy little baby creature just taken from its mother. This is not an animal that your kindergartner could carry around. A one-year-old male sheep is called a ram. They have horns. They've developed a certain amount of aggression for a sheep, if a sheep has any aggression. And they're pretty big. In the 50-pound range. More, they're maturing and approaching their prime. And depending on the variety, even though a male sheep will continue to grow for about their first 5 years, the vast majority of growth has already occurred by the end of the first year of their life. A one-year-old male sheep is an adult fully capable of reproducing and likely has already been used to sire lambs. Now, contrast that to when you buy lamb chops at a grocery store. You're not eating an adult sheep then. Generally, the age of sheep, the sheep you're eating, is no more than about 6 months. So let's get the children's book pictures of Mary Had a Little Lamb out of our heads. And what lies underneath that clear cellophane wrapper in the meat counter, when we think about this animal that God has commanded is to be sacrificed and its blood painted on the doorposts of these homes. And this couldn't be a sickly ram. It can't be a runt. It had to be the best ram of all the yearling rams that you had available. Healthy, vibrant, uninjured, unblemished. Now in verses 3 and 4, it's explained that although the general rule is that one ram per household is to be slaughtered, if the household's small, another small household needs to share in that single ram. Not to be a lot of waste. God values the life of these creatures. These rams were innocent. They were being killed because of mankind's failures, mankind's sinful natures. God doesn't want any more than necessary to be slaughtered and their meat wasted. We find out in verse 5 that a male goat can be legally substituted for a sheep. And in verse 6, that although the ram is to be selected 4 days before Passover, it's not to be killed until Passover evening, which God says is the 14th of Nisan. Time for another explanation. Christian Passover only occasionally coincides with Jewish Passover. For instance, a couple of years ago, Christian Passover, which is typically called Good Friday, was on April the 9th. Pesach, the true Passover that biblically and on the Hebrew calendar is Nisan the 14th, was April 6th. Christians changed the biblical Passover to a politically based Passover. Because of decrees by the early church bishops and then the Roman Emperor Constantine in the 4th century AD, it was decided that Passover was always to be the Friday before Easter. And it would not be called Passover anymore. It would be called Good Friday. Further, Easter was always to be celebrated on a Sunday. And since the Jewish calendar and the modern Julian calendar don't jive, and since God gave numerical dates that Passover was to occur on, not fixed days of the week, then only every few years does the Christian Passover actually occur on the 14th of Nisan. The exact date God described here in Exodus. I hope you get this. For example, the 31st of October is always celebrated as Halloween. But one year, Halloween falls on a Monday, another year it's a Tuesday, another it's a Wednesday, and so on. Halloween is assigned a numerical date, not a day of the week, like a Friday or Saturday. Passover, as we see here in Exodus, is also assigned a numerical date. It's not assigned a day of the week. Here's the thing. The Passover as established in Egypt is a type. It's a shadow of what was to come. It most certainly represented real and actual deliverance from death originally in Egypt. But 1,400 years later, Christ brought the fullest meaning intended to Passover by he himself becoming the Passover. That is, by becoming the sacrificial Passover ram. Remember, it had to be a male sheep that was sacrificed. By trusting God and symbolically and spiritually applying Yeshua's blood to the doorposts of our homes, these bodies, we are passed over for the death that is due to us as the wages for our sin. That was the spiritual meaning of Passover in the book of Exodus, but it was only revealed upon Yeshua's death. All the Bible feasts that, frankly, we have been taught by the church to ignore as obsolete and irrelevant because they're part of the Old Testament, which it regards also as abolished, were set up by God as types, as models, as commemorations for the purpose of teaching and preparing us for their ultimate fulfillment. And although they had a real and tangible purpose and meaning to the Israelites when they were first established, there would be a fuller meaning to each of these feasts in the future. Yeshua was not killed by coincidence on Passover. The Holy Father sent our Savior to be executed precisely on Passover Day, the 14th of Nisan, in order to bring the festival of Passover to its fullest meaning. So it seems a little odd to me that Jews who don't yet believe in Yeshua as Savior celebrate the very day of his death, unknowingly to them, established for precisely that purpose, and they do it exactly in the way and on the day that God has commanded. But the Gentile church doesn't. This is due to the tradition established by a Roman politician almost 1,700 years ago as a compromise to the pagan sun worshippers and to the anti-Jewish church bishops. Thus Gentile believers have long ago abandoned God-ordained remembrances. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd rather follow God's divine ordinance for Passover than man-made doctrines built around man-made political and social agendas, especially concerning this unequaled memorial feast. Well, from verses 8 through 11, God has more details as to exactly how the Israelites are to proceed with this Passover ritual. In addition to selecting a one-year-old ram without blemish and making sure that enough people are present to eat the ram and ensure it's not wasted, God adds the following requirements. One, the sacrifice, the killing, and the preparing of the ram were to occur between the evenings. That means twilight. Second of all, the blood was to be captured in a basin. Third, some of the blood was to be smeared on the two sides of the doorpost and at the lintel, the crossbeam that goes above the door. Fourth, a hyssop branch was to be used to dip into that basin of blood and then use kind of like a paintbrush and put that blood on the doorway. Fifth, during the time that Yehovah was going through Egypt, killing the Egyptian firstborn, that's when the Jews were to be eating their Passover meal. Sixth, the meal was to consist first of the ram itself. It was to be roasted over a fire whole with its head attached, fully cooked, and could not be boiled in water. Seventh, unleavened bread, bread without yeast, was to be eaten. Eighth, bitter herbs were to be eaten. Ninth, whatever was left of the ram uneaten before sunrise to be completely burned up, not thrown out in the garbage, burned up, destroyed by fire. And tenth, they're to eat it in a condition of readiness. They're to eat it fully dressed, this is belt buckled, sandals on their feet, ready for action, ready to leave Egypt. Each of these parts of the Passover ritual have a spiritual meaning. The Passover ram, of course, pointed to the ultimate deliverer from death, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Christ. The bitter herbs signified the Israelites' bitter centuries of captivity, hard labor in Egypt. The unleavened bread spoke of hurrying, of a sincerity, of truth. See, leaven in the Bible is symbolic of sin, of deceit. The bitter herbs eaten together with the sweet unleavened bread signified the bittersweet event that the Passover was, because it was death for those who were the ransom. Egypt, it meant life to others to whom God had set apart from the rest. That's the Israelites. In its ultimate fulfillment, it meant death for our ransom, Yeshua. Life for others, us, believers. The ram was to be served whole, complete. And we're going to see much later in chapter 12 that not a bone of that animal was to be broken. This was a precursor to Christ, who did not suffer a broken bone in his execution, although breaking the leg bones of the victim was customary during our Roman crucifixion, but they didn't do that with Yeshua. The hyssop branch signified purification, and we're going to see that in the New Testament with the cleansing of a leper. We also will find that in Psalm 51. And by the way, no one is quite sure what tree or bush the hyssop actually was. If you go to an Israeli market today, they sell a spice called hyssop, but they will tell you freely this is not the same thing as the hyssop mentioned in Exodus. More and more scholars think that this was really just a species of what today we call oregano. Now, the divine ordinances being laid out to Moses and Israel were interrupted momentarily in verse 12. When God, Yehovah, reiterates what is going to happen on Passover night, he says that it will be he himself who proceeds throughout the land of Egypt, killing all the firstborn of Egypt and bringing low all the gods that the Egyptians bowed down to. One can only imagine the scene that night. Think about it. We're talking little babies, toddlers, teenagers, adults, the elderly. Suddenly, for no apparent reason, they just keel over dead as their breathing stops and their hearts fail. No means of reviving them was possible. People in the streets just collapsed, lifeless, no apparent reason. And can you picture the multitudes of panicked Egyptians rushing to their pagan priests for help, praying in fear and desperation and despair to their household gods to save them? The Lord specifically targeted the Pharaoh as his own royal household lost its firstborn. The heir to the throne of Egypt died. Hundreds of thousands of livestock, maybe millions, lay dead in the pastures from one end of Egypt to the other. You know what this meant? Starvation for many Egyptians. God, unstoppable, unswayable, unapologetically bringing about terrible judgment from which there was no escape, except for Israel. All those joined to Israel, those who depended on the blood of that ram for their protection. In verse 13, Yahweh says that when he sees that blood of the ram upon the doorposts of the houses of Israel, he'll pass by, pass over that home, everybody within it. The firstborn will not experience the death that all the firstborn of their non-believing Egyptian neighbors are right now. I mean, what a sober and dreadful thought this is. And my friends, this exact thing happens every single day of our lives. Every day. Between the time we got up this morning and the time we're going to retire tonight, hundreds of thousands of people across the face of this planet are going to perish for all time. And worse, for all eternity. The same thing's going to happen tomorrow, the day after, and the day after that. But by joining yourself to the Israel of God, you can avoid this fate. Trust God by trusting Yeshua, and you have joined the Israel of God. Trust Christ. Sprinkle His blood on your house, your body. You will have life. Don't depend on His blood. Eternal death is the certain result. There's no in between. There's no alternative. There's no plan B. There's no neutrality. The UN may recognize Switzerland. God doesn't. There is no escape. In verse 14, God makes it clear that this day, Passover, the 14th of Nisan, is to be a memorial forever. Last time I checked, forever means forever. Not until some Roman bishop or emperor decides otherwise. We'll be beginning with verse 15, ending with 20. God instructs the Israelites on how all future Passovers are to be celebrated. Actually, it's more of an addition than a change. Now, this event is called the Festival of Unleavened Bread, or Matzah. It commands that for 7 days, in connection with Passover itself just technically being a one-day event, beginning on the 15th day of Nisan, Israel is not to eat bread with yeast, with leaven in it. Even more, each household is to throw away all of its leaven and anything that contains leaven. There is a rather severe penalty for eating anything with leaven in it during that 7-day period. Verse 19 says that person that offends will be cut off. The Hebrew word for cut off is karet. It means to cut off, eliminate a body part, to cut something down, like cutting down a tree, it can mean permanent separation. Or as it most often does in the Bible, indicates divine destruction and death. So this being cut off is not akin to a timeout for a rebellious child. It's not like a jail sentence with a set amount of time for punishment, or just kind of being temporarily separated from society. Likely it did not, in most cases, mean that the affected person would be executed. Yet undoubtedly execution was at times the result, but it did mean that this cut off person was banished from Israel, banished from his own tribe, from his family, but most seriously, he was banished from the Lord. I want to be clear. This is Jehovah God doing the talking. So this is not so much about the punishment of the flesh or about being disowned by your tribe. This is about being disowned by God. The spiritual benefits of being part of Israel then have been terminated. Also notice that it doesn't matter. Whether one is, depending on how your Bible version says it, a foreigner or a citizen of Israel. Let me put that in the sense that it's meant. It doesn't matter whether you are a natural-born Israelite or you are from a non-Israelite tribe, but you've been joined to Israel by giving up your old foreign tribe and pledging your allegiance to one of the tribes of Israel. This principle that God has no second-class citizens in his kingdom is made very clear here. We're going to find the same message in a number of places throughout the Old Testament and New. What this means for you and I, who is usually born non-Israelites, who have, through the covenant of the blood of Christ, been grafted into Israel, that we might partake of Israel's covenants, is that God makes no spiritual distinction between those who are natural-born Israelites versus foreigners who were born outside of Israel, but now they're grafted into Israel. Does the Lord continue to make a physical distinction between Jews and Gentiles? Of course. St. Paul covers that subject quite thoroughly in the book of Romans. Well, beginning in verse 21, Moses starts to communicate to the elders of Israel, to repeat actually, all that God has instructed him, in order that the elders would then get the message out to every individual Israelite family. Before we go any further, let's get a mental picture of the Israelite population at this time. There was something around 3 million Israelites in existence and living in Egypt, about a quarter of the total population of Egypt. Some scholars suggest that number was closer to 2 million. Others think it was closer to 3.5 or 4 million. Some of the most liberal say that the numbers in the Bible are grossly inaccurate, and that there are only a few thousand Israelites at this time, which defies logic, and frankly, would also defy what was normal and natural population increase for that era. We're going to get into that a little deeper in another lesson. Now, the Israelites were living primarily, not entirely, in Lower Egypt, in an area east of the Nile Delta. It was called Goshen. But without doubt, there were thousands upon thousands of Israelites that had left Goshen. They lived scattered all throughout Egypt. 400 years earlier, the Israelites had arrived as shepherds. But now many were merchants and farmers and traders, and most were craftsmen of every type used by Egypt to build their highways, their government buildings, their military fortresses. There had been intermarrying between Hebrews and Egyptians, although both sides actually discouraged it. Some Israelites lived on the frontier between Goshen and the Sinai, few in the Sinai itself. So when Moses gave instructions to the people's representatives, the elders, to prepare to leave Egypt, some had to hustle back to wherever they were living to get the word out to the group of Israelites who they lived among. It also means that as this huge throng of Israelites left Goshen, led by Moses, they were joined along the way with Israelite stragglers and foreigners of non-Israelite tribes who had heard and witnessed what the God of Israel had done. They wanted to join Israel. In a few verses, we're going to actually see that issue mentioned. Well, in verses 25 and 26, one of our key words, service, pops up. Now, although likely your translation will say, observe this ceremony or observe this rite or something like that, in its place, literally in verse 25, it says, you are to keep this service. And in verse 26, it says, when your children say to you, what does this service mean to you? The importance of seeing the word service is the intent of God for us to see that Israel is moving from servitude as forced laborers for Egypt into service, a voluntary allegiance to Yehovah based on love and trust. Of course, this is a pattern, because when we give our services to God by means of Yeshua, we move away from servitude to our evil inclinations into Satan. Well, in verse 29, a very brief recounting of the horror of that night of death for the Egyptian firstborn is described. I mean, I can't stress enough that at the very moment Yehovah was passing the eternal death sentence on the firstborn in Egypt, he was also delivering Israel from slavery. Egypt was still in that state of choshek, spiritual darkness, while Israel reveled in God's enlightenment. While Israel was feasting, worshiping, joyously celebrating, Egypt was frozen with fear. They were entering a national state of mourning at this avalanching number of dead. As it says, there wasn't a single house, meaning family, without someone dead in it. Well, in verse 31, the now devastated and broken Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron and orders them to leave Egypt along with all the Israelites. No preconditions. Take everything you own, he says, and just go. But he also begs Moses that he would bless him. Isn't that ironic? Undoubtedly, the blessing meant to remove this divine curse of death that had overcome his household, all of Egypt. The Egyptian people were in full agreement. They pressed Israel to leave, as it says, otherwise we'll all be dead. You know, it's really kind of interesting. Even though the Egyptians thoroughly acknowledged Yehovah, and they now knew that Yehovah and his power, maybe better than all of us in this room know him, they still wouldn't believe him. God never threatened to kill all Egyptians. What did they say? Otherwise we'll all be dead. Just the firstborn. See, there's a very big difference between knowing about God and knowing God. There is a very big difference about hearing God and believing God versus trusting God. Knowing about God, even hearing Him and believing that He is simply an intellectual exercise, unless it's accompanied by knowing God, Jesus, personally, and trusting Him. The Israelites quickly packed up all their belongings, including this unbaked bread dough, this special batch that had no leavening in it. They put it in their packs, and they stored the gold and silver they had stripped from Egypt to God's commandment. Now, think about it. Why would God order his people to take gold and silver from this crushed population of Egypt? Well, for one thing, it was going to be needed for the building of God's sanctuary and for the Ark of the Covenant, in which to place the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, and for the menorah, and for other implements of service to God. For another reason, it was restitution for centuries of servitude, forced labors from a people who hated the Hebrews, up two centuries worth. So, when did the Israelites leave Egypt? After Passover. On Nisan the 15th, the first day of unleavened bread, they left the old for the new. Now remember, by the Hebrew way of reckoning, a day is sundown to sundown. They finished their Passover meal during the nighttime, so it had actually become Nisan the 15th. On the following morning at sunrise, it was still the same day. It was still Nisan the 15th. That's when they packed up and left. I hope you get the significance of this. Our personal Passover, our redemption from eternal death, is the moment we accept Christ and sprinkle his blood on the doorposts of our bodies. But immediately upon accepting him, we are free to leave our bondage of sin. We don't have to wait for something else to happen in order to leave servitude and begin serving God. Isn't that neat? Verse 37 tells us that they left from Ramesses, they stopped at a place called Sukkot. Ramesses was right next to Pithom. And they were known in the Bible as two great stores cities. In other words, they had huge commercial and governmental warehouses that had been built on the backs of the Israelites. We know exactly where Ramesses and Pithom are in the Atlantic Ocean, and they have been archaeologically excavated. The place of Sukkot, that's another matter. Exactly where that is, it's as much speculation as is the exact route of the Exodus itself. And we'll begin to deal with that next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.